I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne. Welcome to Radio Times. All Boeing 737 MAX airplanes have been grounded following two fatal crashes that killed all the passengers and crew on board, Lion Air last fall and Ethiopia Air earlier this month. Investigators are looking at the flight control system called the Maneuvering Characteristics Augmentation System, designed to keep the plane from stalling by pushing its nose down if it is tilting upward at a dangerous angle. Pilots have complained that they were not informed about this new software, how it worked, and what to do if it malfunctioned. Questions and concerns have been raised about the friendly relationship between Boeing and the Federal Aviation Administration and the agency's delayed decision to ground the planes. These two tragic accidents are in many ways outliers. Commercial airline deaths have been dropping steadily over the years. We asked Andrew Tangle to get our conversation started. He is aviation reporter for the Wall Street Journal. Andrew Tangle, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thank you, Marty.
Does anyone know what caused these two crashes?
The investigations are both underway. Lion Air happened in late October of last year. The authorities there have released a preliminary report, but we are waiting on the final determination of cause. In that crash, however, the so-called MCAS system you referenced has been implicated, and it hasn't been cited directly in the probe of the Ethiopian crash more recently, but investigators there have said that they see clear similarities between both crashes.
Let me ask you about a story I read about. A number of people have quoted it, and this was about an off-duty pilot, happened to be flying on a Boeing 737 MAX jet that was having problems. The pilot apparently knew how to disable this flight control system that you just referenced. The plane was able to land. The next day, that plane with a different crew crashed into the Java Sea. Can you verify that or tell us what you know about what happened in that cockpit?
We haven't written about that yet, so I probably shouldn't talk about another outlet's reporting, but it highlights the existing procedure that Boeing and regulators have been talking about in the wake of the Lion Air tragedy. So the older versions of the 737 have a function that can push the nose down if the plane thinks it is stalling. There's a condition called runaway trim. It's a long time problem in airplanes. If the nose is being pushed down and the pilot doesn't want it to be pushed down, you don't know why the plane is reacting the way it is. What you do is you turn off the system by flipping a switch, essentially just cutting power to it, and then you manually fly the airplane. You use these little wheels next to the pilot chairs to move the rear stabilizer up and down with cables. So this existing procedure has existed and been on the books and been part of pilot training. That also works to disable this MCAS system on the new 737 MAXs. So the question that has come up again and again is one of pilot training. Were pilots properly trained? Did they follow the training that they got to follow this procedure to turn off the system when the plane, for whatever reason, because of whatever flight control system, was automatically pushing down the plane's nose? The there is a bit of debate, and there's still disagreement about whether or not pilots needed to know about the new MCAS system in the 737 MAX. Some pilots say that when you have a plane doing things you don't want it to do, when alarms are going off and it's pushing the nose down and not reacting the way you'd expect, they might not necessarily think to follow the checklist And they might try to correct the plane through other means. And so that's what the issues sort of are surrounding
sure.
that. And apparently in that report you're citing, the third pilot told the crew, hey, follow this checklist. And that enabled them to manually fly the aircraft and land safely.
But and I realize you didn't cover the story, so I don't want to ask you too many questions about it. But pilots have two pilot unions actually have complained that they just didn't know enough about this new software, this MCAS software that you were referencing. And it just seems kind of shocking as a non-pilot myself that people would be flying a plane that they didn't know how everything worked on it.
Right. I mean, that's at least, you know, one side, you know, of, I guess, the debate that has ensued. I mean, not all pilot unions in the U.S. and not all pilots and not all, you know, people who know this system agree that that pilots should have necessarily needed to know the particulars about this system, because the argument, you know, the counter argument is that the system behaves the same way. It pushes the nose down, and if it is doing it too much, you just turn it off the same way. And you know, these pilot manuals are, you know, hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of pages, and some have argued that it would complicate what pilots know if you added too much training or info about a new system. Right. Yeah, that was some of the thinking at Boeing, essentially, that we've previously reported, that that, you know, it could sort of complicate the pilot's knowledge of how to fly the plane. And they didn't really need to know the intricacies of this new system because the behavior of the system was essentially the same. Now, this is not a universally held opinion. This is just the counter argument to, I guess, the controversy that's arisen since we reported that this system wasn't communicated to pilots in the Boeing manual for the plane or the training. But it's an unsettled controversy about how much they needed to know.
And I'll be picking that up with our other guests who'll be joining us later in the hour. There have been, as I mentioned in my introduction, some questions and even, frankly, some concerns about the relationship between Boeing and the Federal Aviation Administration. A number of departments, so the Justice Department is looking into this, other departments as well. Is that something that is being looked at, just about what this relationship entailed?
Right. That's going to be, I'm sure, subject that comes up next week when a congressional committee examines what happened and examines the relationship the FAA has with Boeing and its role in this entire situation. This is calling into question a type of oversight that we've sort of, you know, evolved into in the U.S. Whether or not it's directly sort of related to what happened here, or how much it's, you know, a cause or sort of the backdrop and how relevant it is, it's really unclear at this point. I mean, the FAA ultimately has to sign off on the decisions, even if they delegate the authority to to Boeing, right? So. But these are all coming to mind and coming up now. You know, is the FAA exercising proper oversight for whatever reason? Because the structure of oversight has changed, you know, with various mandates from Congress, et cetera, or in how the agency actually executes its mission. These are all very relevant questions that are being looked at right now by surely the FAA, the Department of Transportation, the Inspector General's Office, and the Inspector General's Office, you know, has started an audit, but they've also been participating in an investigation along with the Department of Justice.
A couple of more questions before I have to say goodbye to you. President Trump nominated Steve Dixon. He's a Delta Airlines executive to head up the FAA. What do we know about him?
He is sort of the consensus candidate to take over. He's been a bit at odds with aviation labor groups over the years, but he's got a long track record at Delta and is a well-known figure in the industry, and the agency hasn't had a permanent head for some time, mm-hmm. and there's going to be a lot of calls on him and pressure on him to sort of figure out the FAA's role in the 737 MAX situation, and also how it navigates the path forward as the FAA, in a very unusual circumstance, is at odds with regulators around the world.
Has Boeing come up with a fix for this alleged problem?
They are scrambling to work on that. They have been working closely with the FAA since the Lion Air incident, or sorry, accident, and they have been working on an upgrade to the software to make the MCAS flight control system rely on feeds from multiple sensors that measure the angle of the plane's nose rather than just one as it was designed. There are some other changes that will come about as part of this, too, including changes to the manual and training.
Are there questions?
TBD.
TBD. Are there questions, mm-hmm. though, about trust questions that maybe the public or even other countries have about FAA and Boeing?
That's part of this as well. We don't know how this is going to shake out in the long term for the trust of the FAA, because I mean, the big problem now is that, or at least one big problem now is that the FAA and other world regulators have grounded this plane. The other world regulators disagreed with the FAA's assessment about whether or not the plane needed to be grounded. The FAA was late by comparison in grounding the planes, and the Canadian aviation authorities have said that they're going to do their own verification process, essentially saying that they're not just going to take the FAA's word that the plane is safe again to fly. So you've got to figure out when it's okay for the planes to fly again. And that calls to mind the trust question, right?
Sure.
If the FAA says it's safe to fly, are all the other regulators that grounded the plane before the FAA going to agree with the FAA?
Well, Andrew Tango, we're going to leave it there. Thank you so much for joining us today on Radio Times.
Thank you.
You're welcome. And he is aviation reporter for The Wall Street Journal. And we're going to take a very short break. We've got two guests literally waiting in the wings to join our conversation, talking about airline safety and these two crashes within the last 6 months. Stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoen. The Federal Aviation Administration grounded all Boeing 737 MAX jets last week. This was after some similarities were raised between an Ethiopian Air crash last October and a crash of a Lion Air airplane in Indonesia. Excuse me, I got that backwards. Ethiopian Air crash just earlier this month and a Lion Air crash in Indonesia last fall. The investigation is ongoing, but as our first guest mentioned, experts are suggesting things like software, automation, pilot training, the certification of Boeing 737 MAX 8 and the company's close relationship with the FAA, also drawing some scrutiny and some criticism. We're talking about this particular, these crashes and also aviation safety. And joining us is Jeff Wise. He's aviation analyst, science journalist, and author of a new book called The Taking of MH370. Jeff Wise joining us from the NPR studios in New York. Nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Hey, thanks for having me.
You're welcome. Also with us, Thomas Anthony. He's director of the Aviation Safety and Security Program at the University of Southern California. He was an air traffic controller and also an accident investigator. Thomas Anthony, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thank you very much. Thanks for having me.
You're very welcome. And to our listeners, lines open at 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Thomas Anthony, since you have been an investigator, what are investigators looking at?
Investigators are looking at the totality of circumstances, and they start with one central idea in mind, and that is it is never one thing. So when we see an accident, we have the human nature tendency to say, well, what caused it? What single thing caused it? But in fact, these are organizational accidents that are composed of many elements working together, many hazards working together in a chain of hazards that becomes causal. So if we start with the idea that it is never one thing, then we are likely to reach a complete understanding.
Jeff, let me read something. This is the New York Times at Jakarta, Indonesia. As the seconds ticked by on the doomed Indonesian flight, the pilot handed the controls to his co-pilot and flipped through the pages of a technical manual trying to figure out what was happening. Then, as the nose of Lion Air Flight 610 repeatedly bucked downward, Harvino, the co-pilot, began to pray. The supplication was caught on the final seconds of audio in the cockpit voice recorder. What does that tell us?
Well, it tells us that the preparation of the pilots, which is the delegated responsibility to the airline, was not there. So, as with Andrew in the previous segment, the responsibility for the training or certified training comes from the original aircraft certifier, but it is delegated all the way down to the airline.
Well, let me get you, Jeff Wise. Are you with us?
Excuse me, I am.
You are. Okay, I think there were some little technical problems there. I'd like to get your response to that as well. What the data recorder recorded in the last minutes of that Indonesian air crash?
So what we're looking at most likely is, I mean, as the other guest is saying, the investigators want to come at it with a very much open mind, but we, the public, are trying to get our heads around what is really happening here. And based on this kind of information that is emerging, it looks like the pilots were confused, were under a great deal of stress. And when you're under a lot of stress, it's very hard to think clearly. There's a phenomenon called cognitive tunneling, where our ability to grapple with new information is reduced. And it sounds like these guys were flipping out, to put it in layman's terms.
Sure.
And, if you're looking through a manual while your plane is bucking up and down, you're trying to figure out what is going on, what can I do? That is not at all where we want airline pilots to be.
Well, does that mean, and this has come out in the last couple of weeks, a number of pilots complaining they weren't informed about this new software that seemed to be causing some of these bucking problems. They didn't know how it worked, and they didn't know what to do if it malfunctioned.
Right. And the response to that, some people have argued, look, it's a fairly simple fix. If your elevator, the part that makes sure the airplane nose go up or down, if that is in what's called a runaway trim condition where it's not responding to your inputs, it's making the nose go up or down in a way you don't want, you can disconnect that system.
Right.
So that is a kind of a universal solution to this kind of problem. But as I said, when you're in a kind of high-stress situation, you can't figure out what's going on. It's novel to you. You haven't been trained in it. It can be very hard to figure out what to do. Now, the context for this is that Boeing had tried to compensate for some built-in aerodynamic problems that the plane had by kind of kludging on an automated system that would kick in those rare circumstances where this aerodynamic problem was acting up. They didn't want to have to mandate new training for this new type of plane because that would be an incentive against airlines buying it. So they didn't want people to think, oh, there's this new system we have to know about. So they deliberately did – they deliberately downplayed the importance of the system, and they did not mandate training for it. That's the problem.
Well, let me go back to you, Thomas Anthony, and the president, President Trump, when the latest airplane crash, said airplanes are becoming far too complex to fly. Often old and simpler is far better. Complexity creates danger. Is there some truth to that?
Well, there's two parts to the answer. First, just to piggyback on what Jeff was saying, the overarching issue here is automation. And automation is good. It has provided us with the safest form of transportation, the development of technologies. But it also forces, it makes the easy part of the job easier, and it makes the more difficult parts, the anomalous parts, more difficult. So if the airline says, I want you to always use the automation, turn the automation on immediately after departure and let the automation fly, then the only time that the two pilots get to fly is when there's something wrong in addition to the normal landings and takeoffs. So that becomes a problem. Now, what we've developed here and what Alaska Airlines and several airlines have adopted is a checklist to use when you don't know what checklist to use, and it's called ITAR, and it means I've got the aircraft and the radios, you've got everything else, which establishes the primary responsibility of flying the airplane and let another person, one of the crew, try to sort out what this is. So there are anomalous situations that crop up from day to day, and you have to know how to do it. And searching for the right checklist to just follow is the wrong way to go. And I hope that answered your question. But there was another question, and I forgot it.
That's okay. That happens. This is live radio. But let me pick up on something that you just said there. And it is interesting. Airline travel is the safest way to go. And I wonder, Thomas Anthony, whether that is sort of lulled either pilots or regulators or the FAA into thinking that things will not go wrong. And when they do go wrong, they're so rare, people don't necessarily know what to do.
Well, Marty, you're absolutely right. We are a victim of our own success. And so that because it is so safe, people take it for granted, and they take for granted the fact that there are three necessary elements that must work in coordination and in balance. And just like with the United States federal government that has the judiciary, the legislature, and the executive, in aviation safety, we need the airline, we need the aircraft manufacturer, and we need the regulator all operating in a healthy, coordinated fashion. Now, if the legislature who gives the money to the FAA says, well, aviation is safe, it's fine, they don't need as many people, and they don't need as much budget, they don't need as much resources, Boeing can do this, well, then that becomes a weaker element of the equation. Hmm. But it is nonetheless the responsibility of the FAA to certify the aircraft as airworthy. It can delegate some responsibilities to do it to different parties, but the ultimate responsibility lies with the FAA.
Let me just quickly reintroduce you. That's Thomas Anthony. He's director of the Aviation Safety and Security Program at the University of Southern California. He was an air traffic controller and accident investigator. Jeff Wise joining us from the NPR studios in New York. He's an aviation analyst. He's a science journalist, author of a new book called The Taking of MH370. Let me quote Sully Sullenberger, the famous captain of the Miracle on the Hudson drama. And he is quoted as saying that the Federal Aviation Administration has been underfunded for too many years, and that has forced the FAA in many ways to outsource the work of approving aircraft to the manufacturers themselves. He quotes and says, this, of course, has created inherent conflicts of interest when the employees working for the company whose products must be certified to meet safety standards are the ones doing much of the work certifying them. Can you speak to that, Jeff Wise? Is that a problem?
I think it's a huge problem. I think he really hit the nail on the head. You know, when Ronald Reagan was running for president in 1980, he criticized Carter for, quote, job-killing regulations. Mm-hmm. And since that time, there's really been this idea in politics, especially on the conservative end of things, that regulations kill jobs and they should be reduced and eliminated. Of course, famously, we had the current president say that when he really soon after he got into office, that for every new regulation, two were going to have to be reduced. This is a very popular idea, and it's frankly, I think, a dangerous idea, especially when it comes to aviation, because the reason that aviation is so remarkably safe, years can go by where there are no commercial aviation fatalities in this country. Mm-hmm. The reason we've achieved that remarkable feat is because there are mountains of rules and regulations that everyone in the aviation industry follows. And the idea of throwing them away just because you don't like the principle of regulations in general is a very dangerous attitude to take. We have been lulled into complacency. We have taken it for granted that we have the safety culture that we have now. And the FAA and the U.S. manufacturers have earned a worldwide reputation for safety first. That is, it's very hard to build a good reputation. It's very easy to throw it away.
Let me hear a comment from Stu speaking directly to this. I'll put this to you, Thomas Anthony. He says, according to the Seattle Times, and we read some of those articles in preparation for the show, FAA managers delegated safety assessments to Boeing on their aircraft. When you turn regulation over to a profit-seeking company, anything can happen. Do you think that's true? I mean, Boeing doesn't want their planes to go down. Obviously, they don't want to kill people. But do you think there were some shortcuts?
Well, back to Jeff's point, it is Boeing's responsibility to build the aircraft in accordance with the certification standards that the FAA establishes. And so, yes, I believe that the that Sully is right. Sully is a friend of mine, and he is one of the most insightful and intelligent people with regard to aviation safety that I know. But the fact is that, as Jeff says, it is amazing how much of that aircraft and of the whole system is subject to certification. The bolts and fasteners and rivets must be certified and manufactured and installed according to a certain standard. In fact, if we think back to the accident of Alaska 261 went down because of using a non-certified grease on the jack screw. Wow. So the certification goes all the way down to the grease and the lubrication.
Let me get Tom, who called us up from Bucks County. And Tom, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Thank you, Marty.
Sure.
I had read in the New York Times that there was a lack of training on the part of pilots to the extent that they only had 1 hour of training on this new system on an iPad, and there was no simulator training. Do either of your guests agree with that statement?
Jeff, let me toss that to you.
I believe that statement is accurate, and I think that there were other airlines that had even less training than that. I think Lion Air said they had zero training on it. And again, the reason for that was that Boeing didn't want this to be treated as a different and new plane that would demotivate people from buying it. They wanted to emphasize the continuity of the 737 family. And did that turn out to be a dangerous miscalculation? I think probably it was.
You agree with that, Thomas?
Well, I do. And even if it's an important point that even if there is a 737 MAX simulator, does that simulator simulate this type of problem? So it's not just the fact that they had one, but does the simulator do what we wanted to do and replicate this problem?
Let me ask you, and you've written about this, Jeff, as have other people, about what this MAX, this Boeing 737 MAX actually is. And this was a redesign of a 737. There was some competition with Airbus, and they came up with this design. Can you describe what Boeing did?
Right. So the first 737 flew back in 1967. It is a venerable aircraft, and it's also the most profitable aircraft for Boeing. They've built over 10,000 of them, and that kind of success tends to build upon itself in the sense that you have a lot of customers who have these planes. They have mechanics who are trained in fixing them. You have stores of parts. You have flight crew who are trained in this plane. And so when it comes to buying more planes, you can say, hey, look, just buy more of these planes. It's the same as you've already got. The problem is that, you know, time passes. Your competitors now have planes that are more efficient, more modern, et cetera. And so Airbus, the main competitor, had come out with a version of the A320, which had new engines, was more efficient. Boeing was on the hook. They had to come forward with something to counter this. And they said, well, look, we either start with a blank sheet of paper and build a whole new plane, and we get rid of all those legacy benefits that we were enjoying, or we keep the same plane and we're going to put some new engines on it. We're going to tweak it and sort of clean up the design a little bit, keep the same plane. And we're going to tell people it's the same plane. They don't need to retrain your pilots or your maintenance people. But the new engine that was more efficient was bigger. It wouldn't, and the 737 has sort of low landing gear. It lies low to the ground. There wasn't room to put this thing on, so they had to put it forward on the wing, which changed the center of gravity, which changed its flight characteristics. It now turns out that under certain conditions, there's a dangerous tendency for the nose to go up. So rather than, you know, fix this aerodynamic problem, they sort of added on this automated system that would kick in if the plane entered this dangerous corner of its envelope. That's how we got to the situation we are today.
And that's this MCAS, the Maneuvering Characteristics Augmentation System. And that seems, Jeff, that seems to be what investigators are looking at.
Exactly. That's what they're looking at right now. Did this sort of inappropriate pilot response to the unexpected kicking in of this automated system lead to this crash?
Well, let's take a very short break, and then we'll get back to our conversation. That's Jeff Wise. He's an aviation analyst. He's a science journalist. He's the author of a new book called The Taking of MH370. Also with us, Thomas Anthony, director of the Aviation Safety and Security Program at the University of Southern California. And we've been talking about the crashes of two Boeing 737 MAX airplanes last fall in Indonesia, earlier this month in Ethiopia, and all those planes have been grounded while investigators are digging into what happened and how to make the fix. It has raised a whole host of questions about training of pilots and trust in the system. You can join our conversation 1-888-477-9499. Radio Times at WHYY.org. You can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoane. Let me just recap here. While flying is one of the safest, if not the safest, modes of travel, two fatal crashes within 5 months of each other have raised a host of questions about Boeing 737 MAX airplanes, its flight control software, the role of the Federal Aviation Administration, the FAA's relationship with Boeing, the training of pilots, and automation itself. Last fall, a Lion Air 737 MAX crashed into the Java Sea, and this month an Ethiopian Airlines 737 MAX crashed shortly after taking off, killing all passengers and crew on both of those flights. We're talking about aviation safety and oversight with Jeff Wise, again a private pilot. He's also an aviation analyst, science journalist, author of a new book, The Taking of MH370, and Thomas Anthony, director of the Aviation Safety and Security Program at the University of Southern California. And again, you can join us 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes at whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Let me read an email from Beth, who says, listening to the show, I'm wondering if some of the same issues, trusting entirely to the autopilot except when something goes wrong, is going to be an important consideration for self-driving cars and trucks, which seem to be on the near horizon. Thomas Anthony, if I can put that to you, should we have some mistrust of autopilot in airplanes?
Well, the issue goes to the benefits of automation, and one of the decision to ground the aircraft, I think, was ill considered in that it was not preceded by an analysis of all the flight data that was available. Since for the last, let's say, 10 years, airlines have been collecting flight data on the operation of the aircraft, downloading it and analyzing it. Now, since the introduction of the 737 MAX, All your major carriers have been downloading the flight data, which says what the airplane has been doing, not just after a crash, but some on a daily basis or a weekly basis. So there was a huge volume of information and data that was the dividend from this automation, and that should have been the basis for the decision to ground the aircraft. It was available to be reviewed and analyzed, and so that should have been made public, and it should have been the basis for the grounding. And had it been made public, I think a better decision would have been made.
Are you saying the FAA took too long to make the decision, or they just didn't explain their decision clearly enough?
No, I think that the decision could have been made in a shorter amount of time.
I
that
gotcha.
Flight data is available. But your point that it would should have been explained. For instance, you know, they should have said, "Okay, we have thousands of flights that are examined on a weekly basis. We have million data points, and this is what we are finding, and this is what." So had that been explained beforehand as either a base for grounding or non-grounding, then we would have had a database decision.
Jeff, should people be concerned about flying?
You know, listen, statistically, flying still remains extremely safe. In this case, you know, in a way, is an example of the system working. You know, something happened, a problem was identified, we're going to work through figuring out how to fix it, and hopefully flying will be safe after that. Now, the listener had asked about the relationship of this incident to driving cars, and indeed, I would say the increasing spread of automation in our daily lives that's going to take place in decades going forward, and I would say absolutely, this kind of problem really illustrates some inherent difficulties in bringing automation into previously exclusively human performance areas. You know, even now you've got cars that basically drive themselves on the highway. You can kind of kick back and just sort of let the world roll past you. Two things that this does. One, it reduces your the amount of time that you've spent with your hands on the wheel feeling building your competence. You know, the more you do something, the better at it you are. Also, it reduces the amount of attention that you're paying to the surrounding environment. So if the automation suddenly turns itself off, you're going to find yourself in a situation where you haven't been paying attention, you don't really know what's going on, and you don't have the skills to react.
And here's a comment from William, I think backing up what you're saying there. Jeff, I'm an engineer, and I've noticed that we're relying too much on software for these complex systems. Thomas, go ahead, Jeff. Sorry, go ahead.
No, I just wanted to say that this is really a problem. It's going to be an increasing problem, and it may be a fundamental problem, meaning it's not just a question of building the software better. Either, you know, as long as human beings and automated systems share responsibility, there's going to be a problem of how do you hand responsibility back and forth?
Well, let me get you to speak to that, Thomas Anthony, because it does raise questions about pilot training. I'm sure pilots that have been flying for decades now probably have a pretty good system about how these airplanes work. And if something goes wrong, they kind of know the more manual way to deal with it. But I wonder whether new pilots are being trained in all these systems and what concerns you might have.
Well, the concerns I have are reflected by Jeff's comments, and that is over-reliance on automation. But the fact is that there is a tremendous demand for pilots, for new pilots all around the world. Aviation is expanding, and there is a drain on experienced pilots. So this new generation of pilots, while they are adept at the automation, the question is, are they adept at understanding all the things that the airplane is doing? And I think the other takeaway from these incidents is how important the role of the regulator is, and then sort of corollary to that, how important the credibility of the regulator is. And it raises a big question as to why there was why in the preliminary report that was issued after the Lion Air, it was not mentioned that the third jump seat pilot was the one who identified the fix to the to the aircraft uncommanded nose down or uncommanded pitch. That's a big deal, and it's a big problem, and that goes to the credibility of the regulator and the investigating authority.
And that's the story that hit the airwaves yesterday about the Indonesian flight the day before it crashed. There was a pilot who I guess was off duty but happened to be in the cockpit. He knew what to do. He knew what to do to deal with a nose that was going down, and was able to fix the system. And the next day, with a different crew, that plane went down in the Java Sea, Thomas.
And just to piggyback on Jeff's point, when you are in an extremely stressful situation, you have the tunneling of attention. The question or the resolution to that might have been the fact that this person was sort of like a bird on the wire and had the peripheral sense to be able to think in a larger scope and to be able to notice, okay, this is what we should do, and was not maybe he was not or she was maybe not subject to that tunneling that happens in high stress situations.
But you would think, Jeff, that when that particular plane landed, if they had a problem, they would have told somebody, wouldn't they have? Or someone would have known that there was a problem the day before that airplane crashed.
Well, unfortunately, this is pretty typical of a culture where safety isn't first. And by culture, I mean the tradition within a particular company. Do they put safety first? Do they have a safe culture where problems are addressed, procedures are followed? Yeah, clearly that plane should not have been put back in the air. So that's something that hopefully the regulators in Indonesia are going to look at.
Let me toss a tweet to you, Jeff, from one of our listeners. With major software and engine mounting changes to the 737, why was this plane declared a new plane model with testing and training? Then he adds, other than greed. I mean, was it a mistake on their part? Or they thought, well, we'll move these heavier engines forward, but we'll have this system in the nose to mitigate the problems?
You know, I think we need to take a hard look at lots of things in the wake of these accidents, not just the immediate small-scale proximate causes like the sensor, the single sensor being allowed to command this autopilot system to kick in. We have to look at cultural issues that have arisen. We have a situation where the FAA waited while the rest of the world said, hey, we're not comfortable with this plane. It wasn't until President Trump came on and said, I'm grounding this fleet. Which is not how things are supposed to work. Also, it turns out, apparently, according to reporting, that it wasn't until Boeing's CEO asked the President of the United States to do this that this happened. This is a mess. I feel that this is a mess. I feel there should be hearings. I think we need to look at the way the whole thing is working. Unfortunately, we live in a time where much of society is a completely tail backwards, and people who are supposed to be regulating these agencies have been turned over to the people who they used to regulate. It's a mess.
Well, and I wonder, Thomas Anthony, about even just the reputation of the FAA, even America, when it comes to airline safety as a result of this. And it looks like other countries that grounded these planes before the United States are raising questions about, can we trust the FAA?
Well, the FAA has been subject to continuous reductions in staffing and resources. And so can you expect them to do the job that they have the statutory charge to do if every year you give them less money and less people? And so that's a big deal. The other thing is that the FAA is hampered by a outmoded hiring and benefits and compensation plan, so that Boeing can reach down to these new graduates from engineering programs, and they can offer them, they can hire them on the spot. Well, the FAA qualification standards and the hiring program doesn't allow this. And as a previous FAA manager, it was very difficult to hire the people that you wanted, so that maybe the person needs 10 years or 15 years or 5 years, whatever it is, for a new engineer graduating from college and having these brand new digital skills. That's who you want there.
Sure.
On the front line with this new digital aircraft. So the system needs to be revamped to allow the FAA to have the tools and power that it needs to regulate this brand new digital industry.
Let me get a couple of callers on. We've got Karen from Lansdale joining us on Radio Times. Hi, Karen. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi. Thanks
Hi there.
For taking my call.
Sure.
I really appreciate this discussion.
Thanks.
The question that I have for your panelists is, from my perspective, the root cause of this was somebody in the management at Boeing decided that it was okay to base a critical system on a single point of failure. And that's an issue about principles and culture and everything else. And I'd just like to hear your panel's perspective on that.
Yeah, me too. Jeff, can I give you a chance to respond?
Well, yeah, I mean, I absolutely agree with the caller. I would point out that that particular bad decision was made in the context of a culture in which that decision was allowed to be made, mm-hmm. that the FAA had delegated that decision to Boeing. It was Boeing engineers who wrote the assessment of that system, and the FAA just kind of rubber stamped it. That's the bigger problem.
Do you want to speak to that, Thomas?
Well, yes, and that is that the root cause then goes further up the line to the FAA being, what is the culture of the FAA, and what is the ability of the FAA management and leaders to speak truth to power? And the FAA has thousands of well-intentioned and competent people, but if the leadership is advised or directed to be compliant with industry, then that becomes a problem.
Sure. Unfortunately, Daniel, I can't take your call because we're almost out of time, but I'll read what you want to say. This is Daniel from Princeton. His question is, is there a consistency in pilot training between less developed countries and perhaps training here in the United States? Jeff, can you speak to that? If are all pilots essentially trained no matter which country they live in?
The idea is that all pilots should be trained to a minimum standard, but that different airlines can train their pilots to a higher standard.
Tom, you want to speak to that?
Jeff's right on that. KO sets the international standards for all countries and sets standards for safety systems, but again, it sets the minimum standards.
And Thomas, is this a wake-up call? I mean, for everybody, but including Boeing, FAA, the rest of the world, frankly.
Well, it is a wake-up call as to the essential role of the regulator and the fact that all three parties to this safety system must do their job responsibly, and that you cannot have a safe system unless you have a truth-based system.
Well, we are going to leave it on that note. My thanks to both of you for joining us today in Radio Times. Thomas Anthony, thank you so much.
Most welcome.
And he's director of the Aviation Safety and Security Program at the University of Southern California. And Jeff Wise, thank you very much as well.
Thank you.
You're welcome. And he's aviation analyst, a science journalist, and he's got a brand new book called The Taking of MH370. We begin our conversation with Andrew Tangle, aviation reporter for The Wall Street Journal. Go to WHYY.org/Radio Times to find out more about the program. And thank you so much for joining us. Diana Martinez, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, the show produced by Debbie Builder, John Ahrens, and Kelsey Hansen, with assistance today from Susan Greenbaum. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. Thank you for joining us.